and a good Friday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. You can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out our podcast. It's called the Nick Craig Show. It's available in all your favorite apps. You can also listen online by visiting nickcraig.com. You'll see all the episodes listed there on the homepage. Thanks for spending part of your Friday morning with us here. You can be part of the show as well by texting in as we continue this morning at 910-377-6425. That's 910-377-6425. If you've got some comments, some feedback, you want to chat on whatever issues we're talking about, you can text into the show this morning. Again, 910-377-6425. We start off this morning with a very interesting international story. Chaos taking place in parts of Thailand this morning as a massive 7.7 magnitude earthquake rattled both Burma and Thailand just hours ago, causing buildings to collapse as people scrambled for safety. The massive earthquake shook almost every region of the country, and aftershocks were reportedly felt in places like India and China, with the extent of injuries and likely fatalities still unclear at this time. Some of the aftershocks were reported to have been as high as a 6.4 in magnitude, according to the United States Geological Survey. People in Bangkok evacuated their buildings and were cautioned to stay outside in case there were more aftershocks that could have been, 6.4 aftershock. I mean, that's a massive, that alone would be a massive earthquake. The fact that that's an aftershock is remarkable. Dramatic video circulating on social media over the last couple of hours showed a multi-story building in Bangkok with a crane on the top of it collapsing into a cloud of dust. If you have not seen this video yet, it is remarkable. For our audio listeners this morning, just do a Google search for it. You can see and find the video. This is one of them. This is fortunately, it looked like the building was under construction. It was not a building where people were living. But just taking a look at this, you've got this skyscraper that just crumbles. I mean, it's like a Jenga tower just completely collapsing to the ground with this massive earthquake. The crews working in and around that area literally running for their lives as they are consumed by a cloud of dust and debris from that building collapse. I mean, that is just a remarkable video. Fortunately, the building appears at least to be under construction and not fully occupied. Some remarkable video coming out of the area with this massive earthquake unfolding just a couple of hours ago. This was posted right around 3 a.m. Eastern time. So this happened very late overnight. And there's other videos showing the earthquake, the chaos, the insanity in the streets as individuals watch buildings sway back and forth. Absolutely remarkable video and footage. Another one showing water flowing down the side of a building, I guess some sort of high-rise pool, with the water just cascading down the side of the building as these buildings are swayed with that massive earthquake. There's likely going to be hundreds of fatalities, at least if any of the videos and pictures that I've seen are any indication. Police were investigating the scene near a popular market in Bangkok and had no immediate information on how many workers were on site at the time of the collapse. The U.S. Geographical Survey and German's GFZ Center for Geoscientists said that the earthquake was a very shallow one, just 6.5 miles underground, very close to the surface, and at that 7.7 magnitude, causing a lot of chaos and destruction. The prime minister there has called an emergency meeting to assess, of course, the impact of the earthquake. And I found this interesting. The greater Bangkok area as a whole, it's more than 17 million people that live there, many of them living in high-rise apartment buildings, a massive population, very high density, as that earthquake hit at around 1:30 local time. That is likely going to be a major story throughout the day. Stay tuned to social media for that, as the numbers and some of the details coming out of there is probably not going to be great. There's going to, if I had to guess, probably be a pretty substantial loss of life with the magnitude of this earthquake and just that one building collapse. There's going to be unfortunately a lot of folks that lost their lives. We'll keep their lives. We'll keep an eye on it. Any additional details that we get before we're out of here this morning, you'll hear it first. We'll pass it along to you right here on the Nick Craig Show. Taking a look at some statewide news this morning, a big, interesting move by Democrats in the General Assembly here this morning. They want illegal immigrants to qualify for in-state tuition. North Carolina Democrats introduced Senate Bill 691 earlier this week, which would allow undocumented immigrants to qualify for in-state tuition at the University of North Carolina system and community colleges as long as they graduated from a North Carolina high school and attended North Carolina schools for at least 2 years. The bill is sponsored by Senator Mohabij Muhammad out of Mecklenburg County, Senator Greg Meyer out of Orange County, and Senator Natalie Murdoch out of Durham County. One of the bill's key provisions is that undocumented immigrants would need to submit an affidavit affirming they intend to legalize their immigration status when eligible. And I thought this was an interesting thing to throw in the bill. So the attempt here is to give individuals who are not residents of the United States, therefore not residents of the state of North Carolina, to give them in-state tuition at North Carolina colleges. And then they have to submit an affidavit saying that they plan to legalize. Is this going to be enforced? I mean, you can say, hey, sure, sign this affidavit affirming that you are going to legalize your immigration status. But what if they don't? We will have already given them in-state tuition. Taxpayers will have already, in some part, subsidized their education. What happens if they don't do it? There's no discussion in this legislation about what some of the repercussions are, what the recourse is for North Carolina taxpayers that are going to be in some part, potentially, if this goes forward, which it won't. But if it did go forward, what kind of recourse do I have as a North Carolina taxpayer in these subsidies? Additionally, the bill includes a provision ensuring that any information submitted during the in-state tuition application process will remain confidential and is not considered a public record. Why is that the case? Well, because they don't want the federal government or any other facets of the state government to have an index of individuals who are legally in the country. Individuals who are breaking the law. Individuals who are, we're not talking about individuals here on student visas. We're not talking about people that are here legally with green cards. We're talking about undocumented immigrants, right? Not green cards, not waiting for asylum claims, undocumented immigrants. And because this is being brought forward by Democrats in the General Assembly, well, they're, of course, trying to do everything in their power to make sure that this registry, which will, of course, be created, doesn't turn into something that can be used against these individuals. Though no action is expected on the bill, Democrats still filed it. This, of course, is a busy couple of weeks as the Senate filing deadline was Tuesday of this week for bills to be filed in the North Carolina Senate and next Thursday in the House. So we are going to see a flurry of new pieces of legislation taking place over the next probably not a whole lot today on Friday, but Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week, you are going to see a flurry of legislation coming out of the House here in North Carolina as individuals try to get all of their bills filed before deadline takes place and when they've got to have all of that legislation filed. Representative Brandon Jones posted this on his X account yesterday and noted, quote, North Carolina Democrats waited until the filing deadline chaos to quietly introduce Senate Bill 691, a bill that would give illegal immigrants in-state tuition at North Carolina colleges. They didn't want you to notice, but we did. So he was essentially blowing the whistle on this. It was filed back on the 25th, so earlier this week. And the reaction to that has, of course, been exactly what you would expect. And the bill's short. It's only 26 lines. I mean, it's not a very long piece of legislation at all. talks about this affidavit, talks about it being in effect as of July 1 of this year, with applications beginning for the 25-26 academic school year. But that's it. This is what Democrats are doing. This is what, you know, everything that's going on in the state right now, everything that's going on in the country, this is what Democrats are doing. And the name of the bill is even more interesting. In-state tuition equality. What's the equality factor here? You've got undocumented immigrants that are going to be getting in-state tuition? Explain to me how this crosses the line of equality. These individuals are not eligible for in-state tuition. I really don't understand what Democrats are attempting to do with this. I mean, it's probably obvious they're trying to continue down their path of nonsense and ridiculous pieces of legislation. I think most of this is to attempt to, I don't even know how to describe it, to try and win over points with the left wing, the far left progressive side of the Democrat Party, maybe to try and get some praise, get some kudos from that side of the aisle by claiming, hey, look at all these progressive things we're doing. Look at all of this progressive legislation we're pushing forward. I guess maybe that's the attempt. I'm not exactly sure why something like this would be introduced. But this is what they're up to. This is how Democrats are trying and attempting to run government in North Carolina. This is a piece of legislation that is not going to go anywhere. Democrats do not have the majority. Democrats do not have the ability to move something like this down the field. And I don't know why they'd even bring it forward. It's going to get an incredible amount, and it's already, just in the last couple of days, gotten an incredible amount of backlash on social media. Article this morning over at CarolinaJournal.com exposing that to a larger audience. I mean, it's crazy that this is what Democrats are up to, but they are. And kind of connecting this and another story this morning, we turn our attention to the University of Michigan, where they have announced that they are shuttering their diversity, equity, and inclusion offices. This is due to President Donald Trump's executive order. The University of Michigan announced yesterday that it would be closing the doors of its DEI office. In a message to the university, the president and other top leaders said that due to recent executive orders from President Donald Trump, as well as funding uncertainty, they will be doing away with their DEI programming. This is a massive win for the administration, a massive win for Trump, and for, I believe, the American people that have been bogged down for years now with these destructive, controversial, racist policies that come out of DEI. We have seen, unfortunately, all of this play out in the public sphere. We have seen and watched all of this unfold under our eyes over the last couple of years. These programs do not increase diversity. These programs do not increase equality. There is no inclusion that takes place within the DEI office. Now, if you are singing off the same sheet of music as individuals that are all in favor of DEI, if you are somebody that falls hook, line, and sinker for these very radical policies, then DEI is great for you. But if you're somebody that's actually interested in true, like something like, oh, I don't know, diversity of thought, especially revolving around politics, if you're actually in favor of that, like I am, like most of you are, then DEI doesn't work for you, because DEI is not interested in actual diversity. They're not interested in anything that their name actually claims that they are. Right? That's been the scam. That's been the grift of DEI. We've seen what has come of these offices. We've seen what's come of these programs. It is nothing like the name describes it at all. Kind of similar to the aptly named Inflation Reduction Act, which added billions of more dollars to the federal deficit, wasting money on electric vehicles and wind turbines and all this other garbage and nonsense. It had nothing to do with reducing inflation. It was a Democrat big wish item bill Same thing with DEI. None of these efforts actually take place. So the joint statement from the University of Michigan president and others says, quote, "We write today to share important updates related to the programs and central offices that support diversity, equity, and inclusion. Conversations about these institutional efforts have been ongoing since at least 2023. And with recent federal executive orders, guidance, and funding cuts bringing urgency to the issue, we are moving forward with changes that will impact our community at the University of Michigan and Michigan Medicine." The University of Michigan stated its inaugural DEI strategic plan happened in 2016, then developed a DEI 2.0 strategy, a strategic plan for 2023 through 2028. Some of the action items in the plan included enhancing international graduate students' diversity, enhancing Black students' representation and experiences, DEI in carbon neutrality and sustainability efforts, enhancing religious, spiritual, and interfaith diversity on campus. Now, here's the real rub in all of this. The University of Michigan has spent approximately $250 million on DEI efforts through last fall. $250 million. An absurd amount of money. The action items and the things that they talk about, enhancing international graduate student diversity. I don't think there's much objection to that. You want to make sure you've got a robust program for international students? Great. The question is, first of all, why is that DEI? And how the hell does it cost $250 million? I mean, we are talking about a stupid amount of money. The Heritage Foundation found that the University of Michigan had 163 full-time employees working under their DEI office. 163 people is a medium to large-size business. And you've got 163 people working in your DEI office? But see, this is all part of the grift. This is all part of the scam here. Because the $250 million, most of that's not going to programming. Most of that's not going to DEI programs and DEI efforts. Most of that is doing something very simple. It's going to salaries. You are paying 163 people to sit around in a circle all day and talk about how great DEI is, how they're more diverse than the guy sitting next to them, and talking about that all day. Yet, there is no actual diversity, equity, or inclusion that is actually being expanded. 163 people, $250 million? You want to talk about providing equity and inclusion for individuals. How much of that $250 million could have been used providing additional support and additional funding for students on the lower side of the socioeconomic class? How many students could have gone through the University of Michigan at the tune of $250 million? I think that is that not a fair question? I looked at the tuition cost for the University of Michigan. They've got a link on their website looking at both in and out of state tuition costs. If you're an in-state student, the 24-25 tuition and fees runs about $36,000-$37,000. If you're out of state, it is around $80,000. I mean, so it's not cheap, but it's not absurdly expensive. So how many individuals could you have put through in-state residents of the state of Michigan? How many people could have gone through school at $37,000 a year for $250 million? Maybe that would have been a better use of the money. Maybe you would have been able to actually give individuals the opportunity to attend school. People that don't have the financial means to go out and borrow $40,000 a year from a student loan program. Maybe that money could have been more well spent there. Instead, they spent it hiring and having 163 people on staff. That's what they decided to do. That report comes from the Heritage Foundation. I remember talking about this on the radio when it came out because it found out that the University of Michigan has the largest, at least in their study, the largest DEI program essentially in the country, with an average of 3.4 DEI positions for every 100 tenured faculty members. It's insane because it's a big cesspool. There's really nothing that comes of it. There's very few tangible metrics that you can take out of DEI. Very, very few. And the math on this just doesn't make any sense. How can you believe that this is a great idea? How could, I mean, I guess if you're just so entrenched in the ideology, if DEI is your guiding light, your northern star, the thing that you're following day in and day out, I guess you think this is great. There's only 48,000 enrolled students and they have 163 DEI personnel. It's freaking nuts. But that's what they're doing over at the University of Michigan. So going back to why this is happening, in February, the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights sent a letter to departments of education in every state telling them to remove their DEI policies or risk losing federal funding. A FAQ, frequently asked questions page on the University of Michigan's University of Michigan's website, has some of these new DEI changes, and it specifies that services for students that were part of their DEI office, quote, will shift to other offices, which will continue to support access and opportunity. Now that's very interesting as well, and that's been one of the real risks with DEI, is these entities, the University of Michigan is the example we'll use this morning, they are told, you've got to get rid of your DEI office or you're going to lose out on federal funds. So they say, okay, wink, wink, nod, nod, we're going to close our DEI office. They disband the office itself, but they move all of the employees, all of the missions, all of the efforts, and scatter it across other departments within the university. That is how the left is playing this game. They're not actually disbanding the DEI department. Well, actually, technically they are. The department will no longer exist. But the same ridiculous policies, the same nonsense that comes out of the DEI department is now just going to funnel through other departments. These individuals are still going to have jobs and the efforts that they continue. I mean, it says it right on their website. Quote, will shift it to other offices, which will continue to support access and opportunity. They're going to continue to do it. Staff tasked with implementing DEI are directed to, quote, refocus their full efforts on the core responsibilities. And reviews are apparently being made to the university's website to ensure it complies with Trump's executive order. The university also said it will focus on investments for students, including increased financial aid. Again, $250 million spent on DEI. How much of that could have gone to financial aid? Working on things like enhancing mental health support, as well as celebrating cultural and ethnic programs, and working to support academics and scholarships. A statement from the conservative Goldwater Institute praised the news with a hint of caution. They're onto this as well. This is from Matt Beinberg, the director of education policy at Goldwater. He says, quote, to truly restore the intellectual integrity of the university, its administrators must ensure that the institution also eliminates DEI requirements currently forced upon students throughout its mandatory academic course requirements, including those offered under different labels, such as the required race and ethnicity category that undergraduate students must complete. Masquerading DEI. He continued by saying, not only are such requirements explicitly grounded in pushing politicized narratives around race, ethnicity, and racism, as well as radical and ethnic intolerance and resulting inequalities as it occurs in the United States, but they also redirect millions of dollars of student tuition and taxpayer funding for such politicized coursework. And that's exactly what's happening here. The left understands how to play this game. And the question's going to be, and it's going to be a little bit of a whack-a-mole kind of, the administration puts out this executive order. The administration says, hey, this is what's going to happen. This is what we're going to do. This is what you're going to have to follow now. And these schools who are entrenched in this policy, these policies, entrenched in their far-left political ideology, they know what they're going to do. They are going to masquerade DEI and shove it somewhere else within the institution. They will rename it. It will no longer be called Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, but the programs will continue. The efforts will continue. And that's going to be a big issue for the administration to deal with. It's going to be a big issue for the Department of Education. How do we take our efforts? This is coming out of the executive branch, which the sole authority of the president to deal with. How do we take these directives and actually put them in place? Because we know these schools, we know these institutions, we know these entities are going to be dishonest about what they're doing. We know that they're not actually going to end their DEI efforts and their DEI programs, right? Because it's not the name that's the issue. It's the radicalized programs that teach things like, based on your skin color, you are either an oppressor or you are oppressed, right? That's what's being taught. That's what the Trump administration is attempting to shut down, yet these schools are just going to find a different way to fund it, different category to put it under, but those efforts are going to continue. So this is going to be very interesting to watch over the coming years to see how these schools attempt to bypass this executive order, and at the same time, what can the administration, what can the Department of Education do if they're serious about this, which I think they are, what can they do to actually stop this nonsense from being taught? That's going to be kind of the interesting back and forth, a little bit of a whack-a-mole game that's likely going to be taking place. That's over at the University of Michigan. I'll have a show notes on that where you can get access to those daily show notes and more by visiting patreon.com/Nick Craig. We had a great Zoom chat last night with our Patreon members, talked about some of the different news, talked a little bit about the public media, talked about the Trump administration, talked about judges and, you know, how the Republican Party moves forward. What does the politics look like after Trump? A lot of really great conversations last night. We ran about an hour and 45 minutes or so. If you are interested in being part of those monthly chats, we'll have the one coming up here in a few weeks towards the end of April. Patreon.com/Nick Craig. You can financially support the show and get access to things like those daily show notes. You can also text into the show this morning at 910-377-6425. That's 910-377-6425. We'll grab a quick break this morning. On the other side, some hacking and slashing at HHS by RFK Jr., plus an interesting follow-up on PFAS, forever chemicals in the waters here across southeastern North Carolina. Those details coming up here in just a few minutes. You're listening to The Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. And welcome back to The Nick Craig Show on a Friday morning. I will be filling in this afternoon for Pete Callender on WBT from 12 to 3. So I'll have a little bit of a shorter show this morning. And hopefully you can join me live 12 to 3. If not, you can check out the Pete Callender Show wherever you get your podcasts. Some other news that we're getting into this morning to turn our attentions to Washington, D.C. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has unveiled plans yesterday to cut his workforce by about 10,000 current full-time employees and save an estimated $1.3 billion annually. I found this next number to be unbelievably shocking. HHS's total workforce is currently 82,000 individuals. 82,000. That number will fall from 82 to 62 since the start of the second Trump administration after 10,000 other workers within HHS opted to leave the government on their own accord, according to the secretary and RFK Jr. He said, quote, "This will be a painful period for HHS as we downsize. We're keenly focused on paring away excessive administrations while increasing the number of scientists and frontline healthcare providers that can get the work done." He said, I want this agency to once again be revered as a scientific institution. The reconstruction plan consolidates 28 divisions of HHS into just 15 main units, including the newly minted Administration for a Healthy America, under which the agency's dealing with mental health, workplace safety, substance abuse, and more will be combined. So throwing that all under one umbrella category and reducing redundancies. That's been the one trend with everything that we've seen out of the federal government under DOGE and these various cuts that are taking place across all of these various agencies, is just the sheer number of redundancies. When you've got these, you know, 28 different departments or whatever under HHS, it's a very similar work that is being done. Or you've got people that are replicating tasks in department after department after department. It's hugely inefficient. It's a massive waste of money. And nobody has ever before looked at that and said, huh, maybe we should scale this back. I mean, nobody's ever looked at this and said, this is a major problem. Because business doesn't operate in that way, right? Private business tries to reduce as many redundancies as possible. There's no reason to have three HR departments, you know, in a company like in a company. You have one HR department. You have one IT department. You don't need those efforts being replicated over and over and over and over again. It doesn't make any sense. So you have one department that handles HR for the entire company. You have one IT department that handles technology support for the entire company. Each division doesn't have its own IT team. Doesn't make any sense. It's a huge waste of money. You don't need those efforts replicated and duplicated. And you've seen as these departments, the scalpel has been taken into these departments to try and look at what's going on. You've seen huge amounts of redundancy, which equates to waste, just huge amounts of waste. Additionally, the plan will consolidate offices of human resources, procurement policy, external affairs, and information technology operations, with HHS also cutting 5 of its current 10 regional offices. RFK Jr.'s plan also calls for a new Office of Strategy that consolidates the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation with the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, as well as a movement of the Administration of Community Living Programs into other HHS agencies. Again, bringing all of it under similar umbrellas. He explained, quote, "We are streamlining HHS to make our agency more efficient and more effective. We are eliminating the entire alphabet soup of departments while preserving their core functions by merging them into new organizations called the Administration for a Healthy America, or AHA. Kennedy also announced a new assistant secretary for the enforcement role, whose office holders will work to crack down on the waste in federal health programs, with the secretary saying, over time, bureaucracies like HHS have become wasteful and inefficient, even when most of their staff are dedicated and competent civil servants. And I thought that line kind of really popped off the, the computer screen when I was reading it yesterday afternoon. Because the individuals that are in these positions, it's not their fault, right? They're not the ones that created this huge amount of bloat and waste and inefficient work ethic. It was created by the agency as a whole. There was a job opening. These individuals applied. It's not their fault. But unfortunately, they have now become part of the system. They have become part of the waste and fraud, abuse, and bureaucracy of the federal government. They're not bad people. They're not bad workers. But they're just not needed. Their job title is not necessary. What they're doing is it's just not necessary. And, you know, as going back to the beginning of RFK Jr.'s comments, he said, you know, this is going to be a painful time, and it is. I mean, I'm not clapping with joy. I don't have glee in my heart because people are losing their jobs. Nobody wants that. I sure as hell don't. But I can tell you this. Changes have to be made within the federal government. Massive changes have to be made. And you're seeing that unfold right now. You're seeing those changes play out in real time. Because the fact of the matter is, it is completely unsustainable long term. The way in which the federal government operates, the way in which these agencies operate with their massive overheads, 82,000 employees at HHS, 82,000, a $1.7 trillion budget that they have each and every year. That stuff can't continue. We are past the point of no return on government spending and all of the money that is being sucked out of the economy every year. We're past that. It is high time for changes to be made. And unfortunately, those changes are going to hurt. The HHS, as I mentioned, has roughly a $1.7 trillion annual budget and oversees a wide array of services for scientific research, medical regulation, and government-funded healthcare. The department is in charge of critical sub-agencies, including the National Institute of Health, that was old Anthony Fauci's outlet, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as the Food and Drug Administration, FDA. So some major entities under HHS. Kennedy's plan would call for the CDC to absorb the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response, which deals with pandemic preparedness efforts. That's very relevant in our current times. Specific cuts that Kennedy plans includes eliminating 3,500 jobs at FDA, or about 19% of its team, 2,400 at CDC, about 18% of their workforce, and 1,200 at NIH, which equates to about 6% of its workforce, 300 at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which equates to about, which equates to about 4% of their workers there. The secretary said, quote, "When I arrived, I found over half of our employees don't even come to work. A few isolated divisions are neglecting public health altogether and seem only accountable to the industries that they're serving being regulated." So that's what the some of the final comments there from the HHS secretary, a massive shrinking in size. The agency, which was about 82,000 employees when Trump came into office, will be shrinking to about 62,000 employees. Still a massive federal agency. However, all of those cuts are expected to save about $1.3 billion a year. So that is definitely not a small sum of money by any stretch of the imagination. We'll see if there's going to be some legal challenges or legal fights against RFK Jr. and what he's doing over at HHS. We'll keep an eye on it right here. Taking a look at a couple of local stories this morning as the show rolls on a Friday. Well, the red light camera system in the city of Wilmington is officially going to be dead. This is after years of controversy, debate, legal challenges, all of that back and forth. The Wilmington's decade-old red light camera system is likely coming to a quiet ending. City Manager Tony Caudle said he will not be including the program in his recommended budget for the next fiscal year. A city spokesperson confirmed that to WECT News. Though the budget does still require approval from City Council, the contract for the program expires at the end of this fiscal year, which is June 30th. July 1 is when those new budgets go into effect. Wilmington is the last remaining city in North Carolina to offer a red light camera program after Raleigh officials ended theirs last year. For years, running a red light at certain intersections in Wilmington risked a $50 fine, with the majority of that money going to the New Hanover County school systems. Critics, though, argued that the program was a revenue loss for the city, a legal risk, and didn't actually make intersections any safer. And not only that, it's been, you know, essentially ruled unconstitutional by the North Carolina court system. So with that, you've got the idea that this could continue to operate, huge questions there as well. Some council members, however, are not on board with eliminating the program. Charlie Rivenbark said he would like to see it stay and believes it's still working with tickets being irregularly issued. The program, the money from the program has helped the New Hanover County school system, and district leadership presented plans at Tuesday's agenda review meeting to offset the loss of roughly $1.4 million in the next fiscal year. Superintendent Dr. Christopher Barnes said that the money has helped pay for teacher positions and other aspects of the district's curriculum over the years. One idea to offset the loss, according to the superintendent, is adding cameras to school bus stop arms and charging fines to drivers who run through those signs. He says, I think all of us, general people in the world who are good human beings, agree that it's a lot more dangerous to run a stopped school bus than a red light. New Hanover County Schools plans to work with county commissioners on passing an ordinance to add those cameras and getting them installed over the next couple of years. Again, I'm not sure that you're able to issue those citations. That's been the issue with the red light camera system, is there's not actually an officer issuing that citation. There's been some significant legal challenges and battles to the red light camera systems across the state of North Carolina. So while it sounds like maybe a good idea for the school district, I'm not sure that they'll have the legal authority to go forward with it. We'll keep an eye on this. But fortunately, red light camera systems are going away, at least it appears so as of right now, unless there are some major changes to the budget, which we'll begin our big deep dive into those budgets over the next couple of weeks. Those conversations are really heating and ratcheting up. We'll speak with officials both in New Hanover County, the city of Wilmington, and the New Hanover County school system on their budget recommendations and how all of that is shaking out. Continuing that from the show of the past, always enjoyed the budget talks, and it's a conversation and content that you're not going to get anywhere else but here on the Nick Craig Show. On to our final local story this morning, Forever Chemicals. This has been a major topic over the last decade plus across southeastern North Carolina. Apparently, PFAS are being found in seafoam washing ashore New Hanover and Brunswick County beaches. This is very interesting. Samples of seafoam collected by researchers with Clean Cape Fear along New Hanover and Brunswick County beaches show extremely high levels of PFAS, according to a study called Going Upstream, the Environmental State of Our Waterways. According to Emily Donovan of Clean Cape Fear, she said, "Our area has some of the highest levels of recorded PFAS and foam." Donovan says that the chemicals can sit on top of the ocean like oil and water, just as bubbles from a bubble bath. And when the chemicals are agitated by the waves, they create foam that sits along the coast. Now, it's important to note that sea foam occurs naturally in the ocean. However, instead of an off-white brownish color, PFAS sea foam is seen as bright white and resembles shaving cream. NC State senior researcher Jeffrey Enders, who analyzed the data, says that the PFAS seafoam samples have upwards of hundreds of thousands to millions of parts per trillion of PFAS. For context, the federal drinking water standard is 4 parts per trillion for forever chemicals, and this seafoam, which is very prominent across beaches here locally, has potentially millions of parts per trillion. He says, quote, "These levels are a surprise. There's probably dogs that walk along the beach that lick it up and eat it, and I wouldn't want my dogs eating it, and I wouldn't want my kids playing in it." Enders found some of the highest PFAS observed are from our known Chemours-specific compounds. Of course, the Chemours company, formerly DuPont, the Fayetteville Worksite facility in Bladen County, is the group that is responsible for polluting and contaminating waterways across southeastern North Carolina going back to the mid-1970s. It's been 50 years of polluting and contaminating waterways, and that, of course, has been a big issue and a big conversation. Still to this day, legal battles continue. There has not been a single red cent that has been seen by local governments as they have gone after, and rightfully so, sued DuPont, sued Chemours, and sued the individuals responsible for contaminating the waterways, as you and I, ratepayers across southeastern North Carolina, have had to foot the bill for, you know, the granulated GAC, granulated active carbon filtration system over at the Sweeney Water Treatment Plant. We have funded reverse osmosis facilities over in other parts of New Hanover County through CFPUA. If you're over in Brunswick County, H2Go spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a low pressure reverse osmosis plant that's over there filtering out water. You and I have paid for this, yet to this day, DuPont, Chemours, whoever else is responsible, they have yet to pay a penny in regard to the polluting and the contamination that took place. Going back to some comments from researcher Jeffrey Enders, he says, quote, "Seafoam is a symptom to an underlying problem. If you don't change things, it's just going to continue to get worse. The seafoam is already incredibly contaminated. The only way to make it better is to stop it at its source." Emily Donovan from Clean Cape Fear is calling on the state legislature. Currently, there is no drinking water standards at the state level in North Carolina. That's when this kind of gets into a political back and forth. There are drinking water standards that come out of the federal government that do come out of the feds. I don't know that why North Carolina needs its own standards. I think the federal agency, the federal agency dealing with drinking water, seems to have a pretty good grip on this. There's been multiple visits here to southeastern North Carolina. The head of the North Carolina, former head of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, was leading this charge up in Washington, D.C. under the previous administration. So a lot of work is being done on drinking water standards. But of course, any time to get a dig in on the Republican General Assembly, that is that's what Democrats and their groups like Clean Cape Fear will do. It's a problem for everybody. It's not a political issue. It's not something that is a Democrat issue or a Republican issue, contrary to what the left wants to constantly push forward. Everybody wants clean drinking water. Everybody wants clean air. They, of course, claim that Republicans don't, even though you've got individuals like State Senator Michael Lee, who has championed research into PFAS, research into these forever chemicals across the state. He'll still get no credit for it. And then you've got, you know, Clean Cape Fear saying, oh, the General Assembly is not doing anything. Nothing's happening. They're not. They don't care about our environment. They don't care about our water. Typical projection and gaslighting from the left. So a very interesting story there. If you want to read more on it, I'll throw the show notes, the link to this article up in the show notes over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Well, that's going to do it for a Friday edition. Again, once again, I will be in for Pete Callender this afternoon on News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT, 12 to 3 if you'd like to join the show live. If not, you can listen to it after the fact, and well, maybe you're not interested at all. We'll be back with you Monday morning, streaming live 7 a.m. right here on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great weekend.